On the program today, healthcare, the World Series, and immigration. Our series, How the Deck is Stacked. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 25th of October. Good to have you here, as it always is, everybody. On the theory that context is important, with a news story that has been generating screaming headlines all day, this tidbit before we go too much deeper into today's program. Back in 2009, when the Affordable Care Act was in the works, the Congressional Budget Office did some estimates of where it thought insurance premiums for customers in state healthcare exchanges would be in the out years. That is, right about now. Turns out here we are in the out years, and even with the average 25% increase confirmed by the White House today, Obamacare premiums are right about where the CBO predicted. All of that said, some parts of the ACA are having a rough time of it. So from Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes a look at how Obamacare got here and where it might go from here.
When Obamacare first launched, insurance companies thought they'd be getting more healthy people into the mix. But that didn't really happen. Scott Gottlieb is with the American Enterprise Institute.
We've kind of skewed the market towards people who use health insurance, which ends up being people who have health conditions that are costly.
The penalty for not having health insurance is still a lot less than paying for insurance. So younger, healthy people didn't feel the need to sign up. That's according to Professor Amanda Stark at Northwestern University, who had a whole list of reasons for how we got to this point.
The next thing is that there are some really weedsy type stuff like risk corridors and risk transfers that have led to substantial uncertainty in how insurers think about these markets.
To go into those weeds for a moment, the risk corridors were supposed to provide government help if insurance companies' premiums were too low to cover their costs. John Gruber is an economics professor at MIT.
You have to remember, the insurers were in a tough spot here. They were creating essentially a brand new market, and they had to guess at what the risk pool would be.
And now the insurance companies say they guessed wrong. But Congress withdrew some of those payouts to balance the losses, and insurance companies started withdrawing from the market. So what to do now? Sarah Rosenbaum at George Washington University says it all comes down to who signs up.
The more you bring in young, healthy people, the more you stabilize then premium growth over time, because you've got a lot more covered lives and a lot more healthy lives to spread the risk across.
How to convince those people to sign up is something health officials are still trying to sort out. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Up the eastern seaboard from our nation's capital in lower Manhattan, a less than enthusiastic session. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Well, is there something we can see?
Let me set a scene for you. Central Washington, farm country, rolling vistas, apples about as far as the eye can see, and a robot.
That is like the definition of a contraption. Look at that thing.
In the middle of an apple orchard, a bunch of Silicon Valley tech types are huddled over a laptop. They're examining a Rube Goldberg-esque machine. It looks like a tractor. Sounds like one, too. But there is a whole lot more going on with this thing.
So there's a robotic arm, there's a vision system, and we're using vacuum to pick the apples.
That's Dan Steer. He's the founder of a company called Abundant Robotics, and what he and his team have created is a machine that does what seems like a simple task.
Find a delicate piece of fruit, get it off of a tree, and then get it into a bin without beating it up.
Turns out, though, it's a whole lot harder than you would think. So far, it picks one apple a second. They do plan on ramping that up before putting the thing on the market.
How many people will this machine replace when it's at scale?
Probably on the order of 30 people.
Wow.
That commercial machine is still several years away, but it's already gotten the attention of a whole lot of farmers, including this guy.
Tell me who you are.
Rod Farrow of Lamont Fruit Farms in Waterport.
That's Waterport, New York, which means Rod Farrow has flown 2,500 miles to see this robot.
We were incredibly excited by it.
Rod said he employs about 100 pickers in his apple orchard, but those pickers are getting harder and harder to find.
Without a good guest worker program, we'll be slowly going out of business.
How long do you think?
Unless we get a change in administration policy, 10 years, maybe.
So when you think about this election and your business?
No good answer. It's a shame.
That guest worker program that Rod mentioned, it brings migrant workers from Mexico to farms in the U.S. And this type of program and immigration in general is a big concern in central Washington right now. It's creating some unlikely bedfellows and making the decision of who to vote for, even deep in this resoundingly red part of Washington, an irksome one.
Well, and look at our choices now.
It's a tough vote for me. It really is.
It is nasty on both sides. It is terrible. A lot of horse manure.
I mean, I've been a Republican all my life, but I'm having a lot of trouble right now. Is that a good enough answer?
Agriculture and tech are two of Washington's key industries, and they also happen to be the two biggest employers of immigrants. So today, we start with farmers. In a state that may not matter much to the election, but in which the election matters a great deal to this state. It's the latest installment of our series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour called How the Deck is Stacked.
In this orchard right now, we're stripping everything. So we're taking all the apples off the tree.
I'm at Loftus Ranches, an apple and hops farm in Yakima, Washington, owned by the Smith family.
I'm Mike Smith.
And I'm Patrick Smith. I'm Mike's son. I'm the fourth generation of our family here on the farm.
This orchard looks more like a vineyard, really, with apple trees growing in long, neat rows.
This is a new style of orchard planting. You can see how small the trees are, really densely planted.
And they're all like on, trellises or something, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Ingenuity has helped Washington grow bigger and better apples. 12 billion of them come out of this state each year. That's enough to circle the earth 29 times. But until that robotic picker comes along, every single one of them is going to be plucked from the tree by hand, the hands of migrant workers.
Buenos dias, señores. ¿Cómo están ahora?
One of those workers is balanced up at the top of a ladder. He's got a bushel full of apples strapped to his chest.
You should feel how heavy that bag is.
Give me the strap, too. Oh, yeah, the whole thing.
Is that going to work?
All filled up, which it is. The thing weighs 42 pounds.
Jesus Christ.
Heavy that bag is.
He's going up a ladder.
Down a ladder.
And with some chiding.
No, I don't want to try to climb. All right, fine. I'll try to climb up.
So am I.
I get hurt, we're going to sue you. You know that, right?
Slowly but surely, I inch my way up. Just a couple of steps, mind you.
Wow. Yeah, now. All right, I'm done.
And just like that, my career as a professional apple picker is over in less than a minute. Harvesting apples and hops is backbreaking work. During peak season, between 300 and 400 workers are out in the fields, some of them pulling 80-hour weeks. Even though the work is seasonal, the guys that work for Mike and Patrick tend to stick around, coming back year after year. Case in point, this guy.
Tell me your name.
Rogelio Delgado.
How long have you been working here with the Loftus?
Do I tell you the truth or not?
Yeah, tell me the truth.
I was here since 1988. Oof.
So what are you doing around here? What's your job?
Yeah, I'm anxious to hear this.
We're wondering what we pay him to do.
In front of
the boss.
Basic, drink coffee and drive around.
Somebody's got to keep an eye on things, right? Somebody's got to be the boss.
In truth, Rogelio worked his way up from field hand to supervisor. And in the 28 years he has been on Loftus Ranches, he's also watched Patrick grow up.
He was a little kid. I carried him.
Where in Mexico are you from?
Jalisco State.
How did you first come here?
Did you swim or did you?
Well, first time I swim. Second time I pass under the ground. Third time I just cross the fence. Fourth time I pass under the city by the sewers.
Yeah.
The sewers?
Yeah.
It started over there in Nogales, Mexico, all the way to the other side of Nogales, Arizona.
Yeah, and then walk through the desert?
Yeah, for 1 week. Whew. It was fun. Yeah.
No,
but well, when did you get your citizenship? Yeah. He's a citizen now.
Yeah, I'm a citizen now. 1997.
Wow.
Luckily, I get married with a medical
citizen. There you go.
Even though a day's work on a farm in the U.S. pays 8 times the going rate in Mexico, the Smiths say that every year it's getting harder and harder to find enough workers.
When you talk to them, or when you talk to the folks who help you find labor, what do they say about people not wanting to come here? I mean, what's the deal?
The flow of illegal immigration into the country has really subsided in the last, we've noticed over the last decade. We would have people coming looking for work all the time that were newly in the country, and most likely illegally, right? Over the last few years, we haven't had that influx.
There's immigration policy and border security, of course, but also rising economic fortunes in rural Mexico. So to make sure they have enough workers, farmers are increasingly relying on a visa program that's called H-2A. It lets employers recruit seasonal workers from Mexico above board, but it's expensive.
It's $1,300 per worker for us to get them here. We have to pay the visa. We have to pay the transportation from wherever their town is in Mexico to the border. We pay the transportation from the border to here.
Yep.
We're building housing. We built about $300,000 worth of housing 20 miles south of here. We're building another $500,000 worth of housing on our farm this year.
So labor becomes capital investment, like in the actual capital investment terms.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I mean, it's an investment in the certainty of having the labor that we need.
Exactly.
If we had a local source of people, that enough people to get what we need done when we need it done, we wouldn't probably use this program. But what we get out of these people is a hell of a good day's work.
Loftus Ranches is a big operation, so the H-2A program is worth it for them. But for smaller farms, it's virtually impossible to afford.
Hi, this is Burr.
Hi, Burr.
Burr and Rosella Mosby run a 350-acre farm where they grow zucchini, beets, leeks, and squash in Auburn, Washington. And they say they are consistently 15% short on the workers they need.
Costing you money.
Costing us money. We're losing production.
Like the Smiths, they pay above the state minimum wage, but local American workers say they're not interested.
In the last recession, we had probably 4 domestic workers apply for work, and maybe they made it for a day, maybe finished the week, and then left. And we supplemented our crew, our weeding crew, with a temporary worker agency. So we pretty much got 60% production for 20% more cost.
The American grower shouldn't be saddled with not being able to get enough people. And the thing is, these are jobs that nobody else wants to do. We don't like to work that hard.
So what happens at Mosby Farms if you guys run 15% below your
necessary workforce? Well, then we end up going through fields that we can't pick every day. If you pick zucchini, it grows in the hot summer day. You pick every day to keep your grade up. You have a medium and a fancy size. So if we can't come back within 24 hours and pick that again, our fancy size is going to turn into the medium size, and our medium size turns into the extra large size. Nobody wants the big ones.
They grow that fast?
They grow that fast.
They actually grow a quarter of an inch per hour in the hot sun, I learned doing this story. Rosella says it's shocking to her how few farmers the visa program actually works for.
What I think is incredible is that we wouldn't build cars or skyscrapers using this kind of system. But yet we depend on this system to supply food for our country.
There is one source of labor that, according to Burr and Rosella, has helped keep this farm afloat all these years, the Salazar family. Manuel Salazar drives in from the field, climbs down out of a truck. He's a migrant worker and an 82-year-old great-grandfather here on a green card. He's wearing a cowboy hat. He's got deep lines in his face from decades spent working in the sun.
Somebody going to translate? Are you going to translate for me?
His granddaughter, Adriana, helps us out.
What was it like when he first came here?
When the first time he came, for
him it was kind of hard, but as the time passed, he kind of figured out how everything worked, and it get easier and easier, and he loved it.
Manuel had a stroke 2 years back, and he took one week off work, and then came back driving the tractor.
He's 82. When's he going to stop working?
Until he can't walk or something or dies.
Yeah,
he said if he's not working, he feels like it gets more tired and feels like he's going to die sooner then.
Across the farm, workers are washing and boxing up beets freshly pulled from the ground.
That's a lot of beets.
Overseeing them all is Manuel's son.
My name is Osvaldo Salazar. I'm the supervisor in this group for do all the jobs like beet, leeks, cucumber, corn squash, and
everything. You do everything.
Pretty much everything, yeah.
Osvaldo came to this farm in 1992, a couple of years after his dad.
Did he come back to Mexico and he said, hey, Osvaldo, I got a thing. You should come with me up here?
Yeah, you know, I try doing whatever my dad is doing, and I follow my dad, and I'm still working the same, yeah.
Osvaldo's 46. He's a foreman now and an American citizen. He and his wife own a home. They have raised their kids here, including our translator, his 29-year-old daughter, Adriana. She's the third generation of the family to work on Mosby Farms.
And you've been here your whole life, basically?
Yeah, it's since I was little, and I started working when I was 15.
Adriana's
16,
got three kids of her own.
Well, I want them. I really love them, and they like the farm, but I really want them to kind of be more than what I have done. So I want them to go to school, go to college, get a good job.
Manuel still does go back to Mexico in the off-season here, but his son Osvaldo has laid down some roots. And now his daughter, Adriana, is hoping the fourth generation of this family is going to leave the farm work behind, each generation hoping to move up a rung on that economic ladder. Tomorrow we're going to get back in the car, drive west across the Cascades into Seattle to see why and how tech and agriculture are fighting the same fight. Coming up.
I have one of the family here. They are father, mother, three small children who come to school every day, and they just are here waiting and they don't know what to do.
What do you do when your refugee camp is no refuge? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 53 points today, 0.3%, 18,169. The NASDAQ down 26 points, about 0.5%, 5283. The S&P 500 dipped 8 points, 0.3%, 2143 there. We're all about the home today as a bunch of companies reported earnings. Razors, toothbrushes, and detergents. No, not really exciting, but for Procter & Gamble, definitely moneymakers. Earnings up, leading to a squeaky clean gain of 0.3%. Home appliances, yeah, that's a whole nother story. We're not buying them ahead of the election. Apparently, that's what Whirlpool said after releasing disappointing earnings. Shares went into the rinse cycle, losing 10.7%. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Game one, Chicago, Cleveland, a World Series that can straight up legitimately be called historic. Decades since either team has made it, let alone won the thing. But at the risk of spoiling the romance, which, believe you me, I enjoy as much as the next guy, I am obliged to mention here that baseball is a business. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that slice of this year's Fall Classic.
Maybe, like me, you're a Cubs fan. Maybe you root for the Indians and really love the movie Major League.
The Indians win it! Oh my God, the Indians win it!
Either way, you're in for the story. That's something baseball's declining viewership has needed.
Major League Baseball was desperate for the Cubs to make it here, and they'd really like to see this one go seven games, too, of course.
Victor Matheson, an econ professor at the College of the Holy Cross, says TV networks will cash in, so will sports bars.
Obviously, Cleveland and Chicago will be hopping, but given the historical significance of the series, I think you'll see sports bars around the country with tangential fans in a way that you don't see in most series.
There's also all the merchandise sales. So Cleveland and Chicago are set, right?
Paradoxically, there isn't a substantial revenue boost for the teams. And this is true not just in baseball, but it's true in most of professional sports.
Stefan Szymański teaches sports management at the University of Michigan. He says a few extra games won't bring in much more revenue. TV deals were already ironed out long ago. And bandwagoners will inevitably wander away.
These major championship events, they leave a big mark in the memory of fans, but just being memorable does not necessarily make you a big profit generator.
But for true fans of both sides, oh, what memories they'll be. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
I'm going Cubbies, by the way.
All right, moving on. The International Energy Agency said today that renewables have passed coal as the world's biggest source of global electrical capacity. That is potential power, not actual power generation right now. The IEA says China and India have led to a lot of that renewables growth and that the U.S. and European Union are, in fact, lagging behind. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains a lot of that. It comes down to some pretty simple economics.
Stagnant growth of renewables in the U.S. comes down to something you probably learned about in your high school economics class, demand.
We actually have pretty flat demand for electricity, and flat demand is expected in the United States in the coming years.
That's Michael Tubman. He works for the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. He says China and India are growing so quickly, they don't have a choice but to deploy any means necessary to keep up with electricity demand. In the U.S., we're doing fine with what we've got right now.
We definitely have an older grid. China and India are rebuilding theirs from ground start. We need to look at what the newest technology is for our infrastructure and try to deploy that.
And we've been deploying that technology to some extent. The U.S. is second in wind and fourth in solar globally. Greg Nimmitt teaches energy policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says we lack regulatory stability as opposed to, say, Germany, where they have 20-year price contract guarantees for renewables.
That gives you a lot of stability. It gives you takes away a lot of uncertainty, and it makes a lot of investments safe that otherwise would be risky.
The U.S. is moving in that direction, albeit a bit slower. Eric Ortz is a professor of global environmental leadership at the Wharton School of Business.
I could see very easily a future where you start to have the U.S. pretty solid on this. It's very possible to see the policy framework coming in place to solidify this change in the renewable picture.
But he says that's certainly not going to happen until at least after the election. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
After clearing out thousands of migrants and refugees yesterday, this morning French authorities started dismantling the camp that many of those people had been living in for months or for years. The jungle, as it came to be known, was in the port city of Calais. Also, and conveniently, the French end of the tunnel connecting the European continent with the UK. Convenient because for a lot of the people who'd lived in that camp, France was never supposed to be their last stop. From Calais, Emma Jacobs has the story.
Trucks headed to and from the port of Calais pass under this bridge at the southern end of the jungle. It's lined with plastic mesh, topped with barbed wire to keep migrants off the highway. Some have tried to sneak aboard trucks to get to the UK. And today from the bridge, you can see the camp being dismantled. People with backpacks and rolling suitcases leaving for good, the French say. These migrants will be sent to other parts of France. 21-year-old Marion Deloule from Paris was a volunteer giving French lessons in the camp's makeshift school, but she says many of her students really wanted to reach Britain.
I have one of the family here. They are father, mother, three small children who come to school every day, and they just are here waiting and they don't know what to do.
Some people in the camp have family in the UK.
Les adultes qui ont de la famille en France, qui ont des opportunités en France.
Others see greater opportunity in England, says Terry Kuhn, director of a large French NGO called Emmaus that works with refugees. Unemployment in the UK is much lower than in France. Many arrivals in Calais also speak some English already, so they'd face less of a language barrier there. France is offering the camp's residents temporary housing spread around the country while they petition to stay in France or until they agree to be sent back, mostly to Eritrea, Sudan, or Afghanistan. These nationalities are all having a harder time winning refugee status in Europe than Syrians. It's a plan not all French towns have welcomed. And Kuhn says he believes only about 50% of the camp's residents are readily prepared to board the buses to other parts of France. Some clashed with police the night before the evacuation began. And we've seen families, Kuhn says, who have left the jungle for other areas along the coast who will come back. The UK agreed in the last several weeks to receive hundreds of unaccompanied minors. But for the rest, there's no clear legal path to the UK. So France may say this is really the last time. The jungle will need to be dismantled. But at the same time, construction crews are building a wall right beside the camp. The UK is paying for the barrier to make it even harder for migrants to stow aboard trucks headed for the port and a chance to get to Britain. In Calais, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it comes courtesy of James Gorman. He is the CEO of Morgan Stanley. Mr. Gorman said at a conference today in New York that publicly held companies in this economy would be better off if we did away with quarterly reporting of corporate profits. Makes sense on the face of it, the idea of judging whether a company is doing terribly or going great guns by how much it meets or misses analysts' expectations. There is also the issue of short-term management. Of course, all of that is easy for Gorman to say. Morgan Stanley reported profits, quarterly profits, it should be said, last week that were up 62% from a year earlier. So, you know, grain of salt. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 53 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 26 points. It's about 0.5%. The S&P 500 down 0.8%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kura, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.